This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Last week I spoke about some of the ways that we suffer, that we create suffering for ourselves, that suffering manifests in our lives. The second noble truth, when the Buddha is talking about the path, the possibility, the potential to experience non-suffering, to experience well-being, happiness, freedom from suffering, first, acknowledging the importance of acknowledging that there is some suffering in our life, or we wouldn't be here. And maybe suffering sounds a little strong, sometimes translated as unsatisfactoriness, dissatisfaction, difficulty, challenges, hardships. And the simple and general way that we talk about the second noble truth, which is there is a cause to us, our human unhappiness, and in general we talk about it as craving. The Buddhist word, the Pali word, is tanha. Tanha literally means repetitive thirst or extreme thirst. And that term thirst is like a craving for sustenance. Think of it as like an alcoholic thirst. Not just a little bit of cotton mouth, I'm thirsty. Not a desire for water. But a feeling that I have to have it. And that this is repetitive. The Buddha said there's three main ways that craving arises for us and causes unhappiness. And so before I give you the traditional list, I think it's interesting to just reflect on, like, what have you been craving for this week that's been making your life more difficult than it needs to be? Craving, I feel like the definition of craving is that feeling I have to have. I can't really be happy until I get. How long is your list of I'll be happy when? Happiness will come after I get. What's on the list? More money, then you'll be happy. The relationship. How many of us postpone our happiness? I'll be happy when I find my true twin flame. Thank you. Soulmates are like old, you know. Then I'll be happy. I'll be happy when I get my screenplay, you know, into development, or my book published, or my promotion, or my new house, or my new car, or my new shoes, whatever you're... I'll be happy when that feeling that we all have, and that the mind does it all by itself. Just creates all of these conditions that need to be met. Craving for some sort of distant, when I satisfy these cravings. Some of them are desires, and it's important. I think it's very important for us to make a distinction here, because the Buddhist promise is, through mindfulness, understanding impermanence, understanding the impersonal nature of things, You can end craving in your life. By ending craving, you can end suffering. In order for, in my mind, in order for that to be a practical reality, there has to be a difference between craving and desire. And sometimes I've read Buddhist translations that say desire is the cause of suffering, and that you can end desire. And then I'm just like, oh yeah, this is not, that doesn't make sense. How are you going to end desire and still be a, you know, a functioning human being with zero desire, with no wanting at all? Craving is the extreme. It's the delusion that says I have to have it. Wanting is, yeah, I'd like all of the list. I'd like the success and the relationship and the comfort, and I'd like to help people. You know, there's a lot of things that we want to do, and that are, there's a lot of healthy desires and things that we should want and we do want, and that aren't causing us any suffering at all. If it's a want, want means I'm okay without getting what I want. Desire, having a relationship that says, yes, I want that, and I'm completely okay here and now without. And I still, there's still some desire. Craving is, I'm not okay here and now. I can't be okay. I can't be happy. I'm suffering until I get the delusion that that will be the solution. Forgetting impermanence, forgetting that whatever it is that we're going to obtain isn't going to last. Which is one of the reasons why the material, external solutions never actually work, because they're too transient, too temporary, too impermanent. So the three forms of craving. Primarily, the main way that we suffer is craving for sensual pleasures, sense pleasures. I'm sure you see that in your life. The mind that says, even in meditation tonight, how much craving to be more comfortable. Did your mind at some point or another say, like, if this was just a little bit more comfortable, I'd be happy. If it was more pleasant to just sit here. Or maybe the temperature, if it was warmer, if it was colder. If this felt better, then I would meditate more. If this was more fun, if it was more pleasant, then I would do this all the time. But it's not that pleasant some of the time. The craving for sense pleasures that we all experience, that we're born with, it's our survival instinct, it's biological evolution, it's not your fault. Every living being has a repetitive craving for sense pleasure. It's necessary for survival. We are born into a craving system that is only designed to survive. Now, of course, we see in this human evolution, this thing that I don't know, we've seen with many other species, where our craving, which has manifested as greed, which has manifested as the destruction of our environment, our survival instinct is actually going to destroy our survival. Right? This craving that we just want to survive and have pleasure and have, but it's become this materialist consumption technology that's totally natural to, you know, it's the same as the animals have. They also crave for pleasure, and but we've created all of this technology that has, like, it destroys our very source of existence. And sense pleasures, I think this includes all of the material. Why do you want stuff? It's not just to have stuff. It's because stuff is a temporary, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure to have stuff. Your stuff gives you temporary, pleasant experience. That's why you want your stuff. But all of the ideas that I need, I'm a little bit over it now, but for a long time I was talking about how I needed a Tesla. You're mostly joking about it, but how my mind was like, yeah, that's, you need that. You need that $150,000 car that you totally can't afford, but it would make you happy. And I have enough of a relationship to my mind from the years of meditation to not take it too personally and to not really believe it. But my mind was, you know, for a while there, was saying that you should really do that. You should put yourself into a bunch of debt rather than the kind of like postponing and waiting until at some point maybe I will be able to afford that kind of vehicle. And it's possible, who knows? But I'm not at that place in my life. But my mind was like, yeah, but it would, you know, just do it. You've got decent credit. They'll give you one. And we know that, right? We laugh because we know you've talked yourself into that kind of thing in the past, in our debting culture, where there's some idea that that material thing is going to provide some happiness, and we get it. I was thinking about this in my life just this week. I just moved over to this side of town less than 2 months ago. I've lived in LA for over 12 years, and I've always been on the east side. I've been teaching this class for about 12 years since I moved here, but I was commuting. And I love living in Venice so much. And I was having this experience of going home, and it's brand new, and it's just, I'm really enjoying it, and it's such a sense pleasure to leave the heat of my office in East Hollywood and the other meditation center, and you know, a lot of my responsibilities are still over there, and then come and it's 10 degrees cooler, and I can feel my nervous system just relax as I get close to Lincoln. And I was feeling that the other day, and I was with a friend, and I was discussing of how I know, and you know, I wanted it, and I planned it, and I finally got to move over here, and how pleasant it is, but how totally aware I am that within a few months, it's going to just be normal. It's no longer going to be this like new, exciting, I'm going home to my new place, you know. It's going to just be normal. Like, oh yeah, I live here now. And you know how that is with everything that you ever were so excited about getting? And you get it and it's exciting, and then there's this way that we just normalize the pleasure. I think I heard Matthew Brensilver talk about some study on hedonism, on the trying to find our happiness through sense pleasures and satisfying sense, and they refer to it as the hedonic treadmill. That it just never, right? And this is the second noble truth, that repetitive, it just goes around and around and around and around. No matter how often you get what you want, you still want. You still want. You still want. And then it just goes to the next thing. Okay, now I finally got my place in Venice. How about that Tesla? Right? That just, what's the next material, sensual thing that we think that we have to have or that we are in craving about? As a addict, a recovering addict, I can reflect on how much suffering I created in my life, chasing sense pleasures from a very young age, trying to avoid pain by drinking, using. But even all the people in the room that aren't addicts, haven't experienced drug addiction or alcoholism, or also understand, right, this makes sense to all of us because we all see it in our lives, that that's just what it's like to be a human being. There's craving. Addicts have a special intimacy with it because of all of the extra suffering we created in our lives around this delusion that there's some sort of sensual solution. To the point of addiction. So the two other ways, so all of the craving for sense pleasure, and then the two other ways that the Buddha talked about tanha craving was a craving for permanence. So it's not only to get, right? There's all of that craving to get, a sensual, but then there's the craving to keep. The clinging. The, okay, I just want to feel this way forever. I want this to exist forever. And how much suffering, how much sorrow there is when it changes, when it ends, when we don't understand impermanence, and that very pleasant experience has a beginning, a middle, and an end. That relationship had a beginning, a middle, and an end. That lifetime, our loved ones dying, what, all of the living in this realm of impermanence, the clinging, the craving, and the delusion that this is going to be like this forever. Those early stages of the relationship where it feels so good and you're on your best behavior and they're on their best behavior and the honeymoon, romantic, and it just feels like, and you're so disappointed when it gets real. When that changes, when you start to see, oh, you have moods? You don't always think I'm funny? Craving for permanence. Now, some of it we see in our lives as just that clinging, I want this to last, and the grief and the suffering about things not lasting. The Buddha's also referring to a theoretical, philosophical debate around eternalism and nihilism. Do we exist forever? Is there an unchanging soul? Eternalists. And so all of the Judeo-Christian religions and Hinduism and are all eternalist philosophies that say you are a soul that will exist eternally in the afterlife. Hinduism that says you will basically eternally reincarnate. You will exist. You will continue to exist forever. He says, actually, if you want that to be true, and you believe that that's true, based in his experience, his awakening, he says, you're going to suffer because that's not actually what's happening here. Eternalism and clinging to permanent existence forever is a lack of actually understanding impermanence, that everything is arising and passing and changing, and it's not this unchanged eternalist process. The flip side, the third basket, the third form of craving, craving for eternalism and permanence, and then the nihilism, or the craving for non-existence. He said also, in that philosophical perspective, if you have taken this materialist view on life and you believe it's lights out when you die, you might be shocked. You might be really disappointed that there's some level of karmic momentum, that there's some continued process that unfolds after the body dies. So some of it in that craving for eternalist or non-existence nihilism is what he's referring to. But I feel like more on a practical level, that not wanting to exist, not even talking about death, but here and now, when life is really painful and you're just like, I just don't want to feel this. The aversion, I want this to end. I want this pain to end. I want this disappointment. I want this confusion. I want this suffering to end. I want it to go away. I'm craving for it to go away. Which is the flip side of craving for pleasure. I want it to be pleasant. I don't want to experience this pain anymore. I don't want to exist in this. And this would be the root, the fuel for all suicidal ideation. And most people, at one point or another, if they're in enough pain, their mind suggests suicide, non-existence. I think that although we don't talk about suicide a lot, it's pretty common for, at one point or another, the human mind to say, just kill yourself. You don't have to feel this shit. You know how to not feel this shit. Just die. Especially if you believe that death is lights out. Especially those of us who have a nihilistic worldview that believe it's one lifetime and you're done. You can just get out of pain. I was suicidal from a very young age, but I had this interesting suicidal ideation where I was suicidal, but I believed in reincarnation. So I didn't think I was going to completely just end it all, but I started feeling suicidal thoughts and ideation and craving to not exist in this form when I was a child. Like by the time I was 5 or 6 years old, I was already thinking about getting out, but I also believe that you come back. But that sounded okay to me. Oh, you mean I get a new, like maybe like I can start over. Start over at a different family. Maybe I won't be born to hippies. Although it could be worse, right? Now we all know. Now I know for sure. Like my hippie parents introduced me to the Dharma. Wasn't that bad? But I was really experiencing for a lot of my life that craving for non-existence. And I think it's one of the reasons why I loved drugs so much, because it allowed me to not exist in the normal, emotional, vulnerable state of being, and created temporary pleasure and obliterated a lot of the sense of self. So reflecting for yourself on your cravings and your desires, like really reflecting for a moment on what in your life are you unhappy about, are you suffering about, are you... Sometimes we can just ask ourselves, why am I not completely at ease with myself as I am? What is it that I'm craving for that I think needs to happen in order for me to be happy? In order for me to be content, satisfied? And most of that list that the mind makes is the category of craving. Is the cause of suffering and cause of unhappiness. Through meditation, we start to understand impermanence. We start to turn towards the mind and see craving is not really personal. It's not your fault. Through listening to the Dharma, through discussing it, hearing I know for me, listening, hearing the Buddha's teachings, normalizing this, of like, oh, I thought this was all my fault. I thought all of my suicidal and craving, and that was all me. And then the Buddha's like, oh no, that's just what happens for human beings in relationship to pain. You crave for it to go away. It's not your fault that you felt that way. It's not your fault that you constantly think that there's some fix, some material, sensual. That's just natural. That is completely ordinary. And through meditation, we start to understand that. And several things happen the more we practice. One is that we come to accept pain as a given and develop compassion for pain. Sitting still, you're uncomfortable and you still sit here and you say, okay, I can be uncomfortable. Even though there's a part of my mind that says you shouldn't, don't just sit there. Do something more pleasant. You start to change your relationship to pain and to pleasure. And the craving and the power behind whatever function that is in our survival instinct starts to diminish. You start to understand there is not a sensual solution. Even though my mind often insists that there is, even though the human mind often insists there's a sensual solution, you start to understand that's delusional thinking. It's not true, it's never been true. I think it's been helpful for me and for many of us to get most of what I want in this life. It's actually a little bit easier when you get when you've been able to check off most of the things most on the list that your mind said, well, you'll be happy when you get A, B, and C, and you get all of them and you're like, yeah, that doesn't work. The material stuff doesn't work. When you don't have the stuff or the relationship or the whatever it is, it's a little bit easier to stay lost in the delusion that it will work. But once you've experienced most of the stuff that your mind insisted would make you happy, and it didn't actually make you happy, not permanently, it's just like, oh no, that was an interesting, pleasant experience that came and went. It doesn't lead to everlasting happiness. So the more we practice the delusion of there being a sensual solution lessens. The identification with the mind that insists, the cravings that continue to arise for most of us, there becomes freedom not from the occasional or from those thoughts, but a belief in them. The relationship changes to pleasure and to pain and to the mind. And I think that this is really important for us because I feel like a lot of people set themselves up for feeling like a spiritual failure when desire continues, when aversion to pain continues, when there's some cravings that continue to arise. And but through the renunciation that we practice, the five precepts, the commitment to nonviolence, commitment to honesty, commitment to being careful with our sexuality, with our speech, with our relationship to money, livelihood. The whole process that Buddhism lays out for us decreases craving and increases our wisdom of how we relate to the mind that craves occasionally. Now I say that because there's this character, because there's the big Buddhist promise that says you can end craving. And you know that image of the Buddha sitting underneath the Bodhi tree and he's being attacked? Not all of you know this, but there's this kind of famous image of the Buddha on the eve of his enlightenment. He's sitting there and he's got this resolve of, I'm going to stay here until final awakening. And he says, what happens is that I'm attacked by craving. I'm attacked by lust. I'm attacked by aversion. I'm attacked by hatred. I'm attacked by doubt. It just, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm seeing the impermanent nature of things and I'm radiating kindness and compassion and I'm trying not to take it personal, but I'm just, my mind is attacking me. He says, but I'm unmoved by it. I'm just bringing mindfulness. Okay, here's craving. I see you. Here's aversion. I see you. And he attains Buddhahood, full awakening. He calls that attack Mara. He gives it a name, a personification. I'm attacked by Mara, the cravings, the aversions, the doubts of the human mind. But then after liberation, Mara doesn't go away. Mara keeps returning. Cravings keep returning. Aversion keeps returning. Doubt keeps returning to the Buddha, fully enlightened, not suffering, because now he just says, I see you, Mara. He relates to a craving. Oh, I see that. It's a craving. Interesting. Look at that craving in my mind. Silver Tesla. Maybe black. And just watching it, oh, look at that. Look what my mind's doing. I see you. I'm paying attention. Twin flame. I see you. So although many traditional Buddhists would say, nope, no more craving for awakened ones. It's the end. It's over. I'd like to make an argument that maybe it continues a bit, but we just don't get snared by it. We don't get hooked by it. We bring mindfulness to, this is just what the human mind does. Sometimes it says the most ridiculous things, does the most ridiculous things, delusional, material, sensual, anger. It just, this is what the human mind does. And if we're not paying it, if we're not mindful, if we're not present, we just get caught off guard by it and we suffer and we create all kinds of suffering for ourselves and others. We take it personal. We believe it. But with the practices that we're doing, the level of renunciation that we establish, the mindfulness we're establishing, there's the potential to not suffer about what the mind does. Including the cravings that may arise and pass. The good news is, everything's impermanent. The bad news is, everything's impermanent. These are some of my thoughts about the cause of suffering and how we can change our relationship to it, and the importance of understanding it and understanding how it's not your fault, the cravings, but it's completely our responsibility of how we're going to relate to them, how personal we're going to take them. There's some choice. With practice, there's some choice. Any questions or comments about this, please?
Cravings are things like a Tesla, or things like a snack, mm-hmm. you know, but when the craving is for an adequately functioning justice system, accessible healthcare, you know, housing, how does the philosophy translate or change, and how does the response to that, would you consider that a craving?
Could you hear the question in the back? No, I'll try to repeat it. She said it makes sense. She could understand if we're talking about something silly like a... She didn't say this, I'm saying that. Like a car. But what about when we're talking about something more serious like justice and adequately functioning healthcare system or equality or poverty, when we're, you know, we're talking about actually more serious suffering in dysfunctional systems, corruption in our world. And is it possible, is what I'm hearing from this perspective, to not crave for it to be different than it is? Correct me.
I guess I'm not worried about, I don't know, I mean, would you consider, you know, the lust or the end of police brutality, for example, would you consider that lust, would you consider that a craving? I guess that's my first question, and then I have a follow-up, if that's all right.
Craving for a second question.
The equation in Buddhism is always, are you suffering about it? The world is the way that it is right now. And the way that it is, from my perspective, is incredibly unjust and filled with corruption and ruled by greed and hatred and delusion. And it is the way that it is. And there's a level of acceptance that there's a whole bunch of broken, racist, sexist systems in place in our world. The question is, how much am I, as the individual, you, us, how much are we suffering about that? Of course, I mean, hopefully, not of course, but in this realm, of course, there's a healthy desire to create a positive change. Of course, there's a commitment to saying it's not okay. And that acceptance doesn't mean complacency or not doing anything about it, but it means seeing it clearly, acknowledging, yes, okay, this is broken and this is broken and this is broken and all this harm is being caused. And out of compassion, out of, I guess mostly the motivation for me is compassion, not hatred, not I want to kill the ignorant oppressors, but out of compassion for the suffering and harm being caused, both being experienced both by the oppressors and the oppressed, both by the karma created from the corporate greed that's ruling our government and all of the people affected by that greed. Objectified by it. So, from the Buddhist perspective, and you know, we can look at the Buddha's teachings and look at the world he was in. Although it's an ancient society, it was a very racist society. It was a very sexist society. It was war-torn and filled with oppression. And these teachings about craving are as applicable now as they were then. And I think that the technology of oppression has and capitalism has like increased for sure over the last couple thousand years. There's like people know how to oppress each other even better. there's a technology behind it now that they didn't have then. It was just like the warring factions went in and killed everybody and took slaves and, you know, kept the caste system in place and kept women oppressed. And so my feeling is that, yes, we can take this perspective of wanting a positive change and not suffering about needing it to happen right now, continuing to work for a positive change. out of a compassionate desire and not out of a, I'm going to continue suffering until we get justice. That we can actually, and that's what the Buddha did, was that he ended suffering in his life, and he'll say what he encouraged everyone. He said, end suffering in your own heart and work for a positive change. Dedicate your life's energy to creating a positive change, to fixing some of these broken systems as much as we can. With the life, for me, there's a level of acceptance that I won't be able to do it all, but that I'll continue to work for it. That kind of bodhisattva ethic that says, I'm going to keep trying even though I know I can't quite do it. You know the bodhisattva vows? I like the Japanese statement, better than the Tibetan statement myself, because I feel like there's more of a sense of humor about it, where they say, suffering is endless and I vow to end it all. Because it feels like that when I look at this world. It feels like suffering is endless. And I'm committed to alleviating my own suffering and to doing what I can to help others alleviate theirs, which includes some political engagement with the systems of oppression. But understanding that I don't think I'm going to end it all, but I'm going to keep trying. Was there a second part? Did I address the first part enough?
That was thorough.
Okay. Yeah, thank you. Please.
I don't know if my question is kind of similar, but along a different line. I mean, however many thousands of years ago that it was that the Buddha was alive, I mean, I realized that he was pretty much in the same position that I am now. You know, like he traveled and he didn't actually have a home and he didn't actually have a job. it doesn't really work that way today. I mean, in the position that I'm in right now, you know, because when you talked about what are you craving for, like all I can think of is I just want some stability. I want financial stability, and I want to know that I have this roof over my head for however long, you know, like I signed this lease, so I'm going to have this roof over my head for the next year. I'm suffering over this lack of stability. I'm suffering over the fact that everything's impermanent, and I just want some stability in an impermanent world. But at the same time, I mean, there is this, I mean, in this world that we live in, you can't continue to exist in it without some financial stability and you know, a place to call home, I suppose. I guess, what are your thoughts on that?
There are still a lot of communities that will accept people to come and live free of charge. If you're interested in dedicating your life to spiritual practice, you can go become a nun or a monk. You can live in a monastery. People will feed you and house you and clothe you in orange robes. And that it is an option. Monasticism, as the Buddha encouraged and practiced, is an option. Now, it's actually interesting that even that I came very close to being a monk, and some of my teachers are monastics for decades and decades, and even that, like actually, they won't the monasteries that I like in the States, they won't take you if you have any debt. Because you can't be a burden to the Sangha. You need to come in. You need to come into the Sangha, into the monastery, without having a sort of financial burden to bear upon the community that's going to support you. But if you've kind of cleaned up your debt, and hopefully you have somebody that might support you a little bit with some health insurance or something, monasticism, that kind of thing that the Buddha was doing. And he was doing it in a way that was way different than what they're doing now, where he was homeless, really homeless, and walked away from the most stability, from a palace, supposedly. And he said, actually, this stability, this security, didn't work. I wonder what it's like on the streets. I wonder what it's like in the forest. I wonder what it's like to have no burden of a lease. Now, it's a little bit of a romantic ideal. And I think that the reality is we're all choosing, for the most part choosing, to say, actually, I want to have a home. I'm in the West. I'm in a materialist, capitalist society. I want to have a good job. I want to have a secure life. I want to do all of that. But mostly, I think we should take responsibility for that something that we're choosing. Just like the suffering of relationships, that celibacy is an option. Any suffering you experience in relationships, you're choosing. Because you could make the other choice, which is don't be in relationships. Any of the, so, you know, and it's a little, I feel like on that I have a stronger argument for around sex, is that it's really a choice. You do not have to have sex. A home, yeah, maybe you need a home. It's not quite the society that it, you know, would support homelessness. You know, here it's a crime. It's not safe. It's not safe for a woman to, you know, it's not safe. Like in probably most places, it's not. But. All of that having been said, you are doing what needs to be done to find the relative security of a home. I'm sure that there's a lot of people in this room who've thought that they had the security of a home and there was a fire or there was an earthquake or you lost your lease or the landlord sold it out from under you. I mean, this, right? Like all of that has happened. Well, you thought, like, I'm good. And then all of a sudden, your rent got doubled and you were back to not having that security. Buddhism does have a really high bar, which says actually you can be happy no matter what. Home or no home, success or no success, relationship or no relationship, money or poor, poverty. That you can have a sense of compassion and non-attachment and generosity that's not dependent on the circumstances of your life. That's not about getting everything lined up the way that you want it to be. And then there's the other side, which I was mostly talking about tonight, is that most of us, you know, kind of you get everything the way you want it to be and you say, oh, that didn't work either. It's not that, you know, there isn't this sort of like magic once I have the lease now, you know, right? Because now you have the lease, right? Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, did you say you signed a lease?
Oh, no.
No, you're
still
looking
for a place.
Right.
But what you said about the landlord selling the house out for money, that's what just happened.
Sure. Sure, but what's going to happen next is you're going to find a place and you're going to sign a lease and then your mind is going to find something else to suffer about. Right, there's going to be the next level of, yeah, but something else is wrong now that I have a place to live. Okay, I want to leave it there tonight.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.